Our subject this morning is the tension, or friction, or controversy between the friends and others in early English history. From the very beginning, as you've seen from Fox's journal, his career was filled with maybe conflict is the word I'm thinking of. I'm trying to think of a neutral word for the experience of friends in this period. Beginning with the beginning, for 40 years about, this conflict lasted. So in all these 17th century friends, it is a common experience. And today I would like to say something about its character and its meaning in a general way. Obviously, the two sides looked at the situation differently. Perhaps I shouldn't say two sides, but the opposite sides, whatever they were. The state religion looked differently at all the nonconformists, including the Quakers. And then the various nonconformists differed from one another. Even the little groups. As often happens, you know, the more people have in common, the more they quarrel. Whereas you can lump together the nonconformists over against the public opinion in general, the state church and the state government. Well, there's a common social phenomenon. I'm sorry to say we know a great deal about in our country. People with different views of various kinds, political, people with various racial backgrounds and so on. We know all about this. I don't need to tell you that there was a great deal to be said on both sides, and that both sides had their arguments, and there was a great deal of retaliation, a great deal of similarity in the criticism both ways around. And by picking out the Quakers, I'm simply picking out a common phenomenon. Quakers, to begin with the viewpoint of the other side, were annoyed, undoubtedly annoyed, and easily liable to suspicion. Suspicion for their ideas and suspicion of their behavior, of their known behavior and of their suspected behavior, of their known opinions and of their suspected opinions. The element of suspicion over and above evidence against them was such as we are familiar with today, are we not? In our international or political or racial conflict. On the religious side, and that was very much more important in those days than these. They were suspected of heresy and the worst kinds of heresy. They believed, as you know, in direct divine revelation. Well, what's that do to the Bible? Depresses it at once, doesn't it? What does that do to the historical element in the Christian religion? The kind of Christianity that believes that in the life and death of Christ, God gave his last and final and supreme message to mankind. Well, now people come along and say, why? He can talk to us. We can hear from him. That at once puts them under suspicion. friends are still accused of historic ingratitude. You understand what that means? It means that they're indifferent to that which once was done for us, without us, once for all. It also meant that the friends were indifferent to the institution which carried on traditional Christianity. That is, the church, with its repeated rituals of baptism and the Lord's Supper. That is, the official clergy of the church. These privileged people, authorized people, these authorized institutions and acts, well, the Quakers seem to be completely indifferent to them. Now, the Quaker answer to this is fairly simple, but I won't say effective under the circumstances. Quaker answer was that they believed that in the New Testament God had spoken to Christ and the apostles. In the Old Testament he had spoken to the prophets, and they were merely doing what was done long ago. They believed that they were continuers of the early time. Like other Christians, they said they represented primitive Christianity. That's what the debates were all on. The Baptist says we're like the early Christians, and the Quaker said we're like the early Christians, and then you take your New Testament and thumb it back and forth and argue on that basis. The Quakers rather skipped the interval of tradition between, and anything that had grown up since the first century, they were willing to omit. They wanted to jump all the way back. They claimed that they did. Everything that happened since the apostolic age was apostasy. The church had declined. We are still inclined to say the church went bad. These Protestants are, that the church went bad under Constantine when it became affiliated with the state. And when, well, it's Protestants again talking, that the growth of Roman Catholic tradition, the Pope, all those things are defection. The Quakers went back to the earliest time in Christianity. They used the Bible not as authority, but as an example of what pure religion would be like for them to practice themselves and for them to experience in their religious life. Everything in between, and this they could argue with in talking to other Protestants, like the Anglican Church, everything in between had been brought in by the Catholic Church. As I've said before, they simply were more extreme in their desire to carry the so-called Reformation to its ultimate conclusion. Not satisfied with that, they went even further back. They said that in the Garden of Eden, when man was first created, he was perfect, without sin. And that everything from then on down was a characteristic of fallen mankind in his worst state. Therefore, they kept talking, Fox particularly, and if you haven't met it yet, I'm surprised, the phrase, as it was before the fall, or as Adam was before the fall. That's a very common phrase in his. And therefore he called men to go back, not only to practice Christianity as it was in the first century, but to recover the lost innocence and purity of human life before sin entered the world. This of course agreed with what we've already been speaking of before, their belief that man could be good. the possibility of being perfect, of recovery. Their view was that Christ had come and is still here to enable men to get back to where they once were, the very beginning. And of course, the idea of original sin, which the Calvinists emphasized, wasn't too much in favor with the Quakers. Well, none of this seemed like pure blasphemy. To claim, for any individual to claim, that he could escape this original sin, that he could be made perfect, that was bad. And then to claim that the Spirit of God, as it was in the prophets and in Christ and the apostles, was in him, well, that's nothing short of blasphemy. People said to the Quaker, have you the Spirit of God? They said, yes. Nobody else claimed that. They all say that had people had it, well, that seemed like blasphemy. In the year 1650, a law was passed in England just in time to catch the Quakers, you see, just before they began. A law against blasphemy. Well, that law was just one of the tools that could be used. And I suppose you're aware of the fact that today, in trying to catch integrationists or communists or frontists, all kinds of old-fashioned laws are being used. Every legal device is employed, and so it was with the Quakers. You don't have to, and for the first 10 years, that is under the Commonwealth, they didn't pass any laws at the Quakers. Nothing like the Smith Act. I'm talking language you understand, I hope. Nothing like the Smith Act against the Quakers until about 1662, 10 years, you see, after they began. So using these old laws, vagrancy laws, law against blasphemy, law requiring an oath of allegiance, they had plenty of persecuting tools at hand. They used them freely and stretch them a little bit. The law against the Catholics, of course, required an oath of allegiance and renouncing the Pope. Well, the Quakers didn't mind renouncing the Pope. They did that with a good heart, but they wouldn't take an oath about it, you know. That's the difference. And so they were caught, just as some innocent people today are caught on the anti-communist laws. Not that they're pro-communist in the least. But they're just so particular, so conscientious, that they won't let themselves do what they could do to prove themselves non-communists. The friends were also suspected morally. It's a very common view, and I don't believe we're quite over it yet in our civilization, that if your theology is unorthodox, if, for instance, you're, I might say, a Unitarian, other people will think that means you're immoral. There's a theory that you aren't moral, that you don't even keep the Ten Commandments, unless you take an orthodox view of the Christian religion. Now, that's a very common assumption.